At this time, it is my great pleasure to bring to the stage our U.S. Chief Technology Officer, Megan Smith, and she is going to help bring that tech and innovation lens to this discussion and a little bit more. So thanks, Megan. Come on up.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much, and thanks to everybody for being here. This is one of the most important topics in our country, which is how do we field the whole American team? How do we field the whole American team in government? How do we field the whole American team in every single thing we do, in school, on campus, in our workforce, in our families, like everywhere? And it's one of the things that, that is the greatest opportunity of this century. And as we wake up and see how valuable it is to include everyone, that also helps drive us. Because there's both the sort of moral and social part of this. There's also the prosperity and economic part of this, the solving problems part of this, that's interesting. And so I just wanted to read, the president issued a memorandum about national security and diversity. And in it, he has a really interesting thing that he's saying. And I'll just quickly read this short little excerpt. The research has shown that diverse groups are more effective at problem solving than homogenous groups. And policies that promote diversity and inclusion will enhance our ability to draw from the broadest possible pool of talent, solve our toughest challenges, maximize employee engagement and innovation, and lead by example by setting a high standard for providing access to opportunity to all segments of our society. So just really knowing, which so many people, you guys are the people doing this work, that's why you're at this conference, that's why you're working together, and I see Beth, like the OPM leadership on this. It's in what we know about the prosperity agenda, the social solution agenda, and why this is some of the most important work in the country. So you might say, you know, why is the chief technology officer talking about this? Because the job, our job is to help the president and his team harness the power of data, innovation, and technology on behalf of the American people and the world. And really, the best thing that you can do is crowdsource the solutions by activating all the talent in our country and our government to do what it would do. Because people are inspired about different topics and they will work on extraordinary things if we give them the capacity, capability, and open the door so they can do that. And so we can really solve, and it's been so exciting to work on this job. One of my favorite things we call scout and scale. We look around for who's already got it figured out. Because a lot of times the venture capitalists do that. They certainly look around and they find the Twitters and the Amazons and these things that are out there, these amazing inventors. And then they come up, they venture capitalize them, they venture catalyze them, is what we can do. And so whether it was some of the early work that we did around justice and technology and innovation, we found things like the Miami-Dade team had determined that about a third of the people who were incarcerated on their watch were having substance abuse or mental health challenges. And so they came up with a new strategy several years ago. They opened a 12-bed stabilization unit in their hospital. And then they trained the police, and they trained 911. And so every time they were encountering someone suffering in this particular way, instead of taking them to jail or the ER, they brought them to this stabilization unit. And over 4 years, they had about 50,000 people who matched this, who went through this other system, and only 109 arrests. And they went from 7,000 people in prison to 4,900, closed a jail, and on top of that, saved an extraordinary amount of money. So they saved people's lives. They saved the families. They improved how they were doing things. And it was through sort of a data methodology of looking through how to do this and coming up with innovative solutions together. What we ended up doing with that insight and some other insights from Camden, New Jersey, and San Diego and other places was created a working group of leadership in the criminal justice area who wanted to see if they could copy that idea. They had the same challenges in their city and they wanted to use those new methods. So we started a working group and it's nicknamed Data-Driven Justice, and we launched that with the president. There's now 127 jurisdictions in that group, and between that and the Police Data Initiative, which is a transparency and sharing of data, Dallas and LA, again, scouting, had been opening up officer-involved shooting, use of force data, other data sets, and sharing that with the public and beginning a different conversation and really learning from that. Now there's over 100 jurisdictions in that. So 94 million Americans covered by jurisdictions who are now acting in a new way together, lifting each other. And one of my favorite moments of talk about talent, in New Orleans, a 10th grader, Grace, was busy with Operation Spark learning coding, and she got pulled into these programs, and now the high schoolers are part of a working group, and she was teaching the chief of police for New Orleans how to code. And they were working on these problems together. So how might we take this new stuff that seems new-ish and in certain parts of the city and bring it to all our problems together, including this one? And so I gave you guys a quick handout of a data visualization. Sometimes we don't realize where the answers and where the problems lie. And so one of them is in, I don't know if I have it up there, but you have the graphic with the chart. Yeah, Beth, hold that up. Okay, see that one? All right, so what's interesting on that is it's a graphic where somebody has added up in media. What is the bias in media? We always know there's bias in media. What is the bias? Could we measure it? These people counted who gets to speak. So they did it by gender on this particular page, and it's the little graphic on the bottom right is in children's TV, boys' lines to girls' lines. And we think Frozen is a girls' film, but it's 54% boy lines. Mulan is a girl film, but it's 74% boy lines. Most of the films our children are watching are, you know, well above 70% boys or men speaking instead of girls or women. Then when we grow up, we continue that media making. The larger graphic shows all the films, 2,000 films we watched, men's lines to women's lines. So we didn't know we were doing that to ourselves. So none of us created any of the stuff that we're dealing with. Hundreds of years of culture challenges. But now we can start to use these tools to see the things we might see in our societies. And it'll change us. Because as soon as you see that graphic, you're like, uh-oh, I don't want my kids to have this imbalance. I want the boys and girls to have the confidence and to feel like they all should talk. Let's go. You know, and let's start measuring this stuff in those ways. So I wanted to share that graphic because it's a really great example of where we could use data all around, whether it's in media representation or whether it's what we're doing within our communities. The other piece that I handed out, and Laura Webb Powers is here, and we've been working together on this work with lots of other colleagues. I see Wanda and back, OSTP teammates, and others, on this grid. This is a grid where we know that there's a bunch of best practices around diversity and inclusion in the workplace that live around what leadership could do, what we should do around advancement and retention. We have such a leaky pipe. We're losing so many people, and they're not moving up in the right way. You can look at that unconscious bias training. It's so interesting. If you run a model where you take, this is amazing research, you take a group of people, split it into two groups, give them a rating on their performance review, a difference of 0.1, and then run the cycle through 20 promotions, one group will work for the other. So it's in that tiny little insidious changes in our reviews that we don't advance each other in the ways that we could, right? So what are the practices to debug that in advancement and in retention and getting people into the C-suite or wherever it is that they want to go? The third area on that grid is about hiring. We put it later because a lot of times people want to solve problems of diversity and inclusion and equity, and they're busy thinking about K-12, you know, sort of go, they go right to first grade. Yes, and what about the people in the office right today? So let's do both. Let's work on both. So hiring near term and hiring long term, you know, especially in STEM inclusion with how we're teaching tech. And then the last one is about the ecosystem, like the groups like this. We are a networked team of set of teammates. Are there research partners? Are there those who would catalyze us and put us together? What's available to us in the partnership of the ecosystem around us for our own workplace so we can work the three areas there? In the area of leadership, I just wanted to mention an example that I saw that was really extraordinary from IBM in the 90s, which is a big part of IBM turning itself around. It was Lou Gerstner. And what he did, he said to his management team, which was not diverse, he said, look, we're not a diverse team. We're not going to be a diverse team in the next 6 months. We're going to start working on this. But what I want each of you to do is I want you to become very close to one of our employee resource groups. I want you to adopt them. I don't want you to just be their exec rep. I want you to go to their events. I want you to talk to them. And we're going to add to our agenda on a regular basis a conversation about the diversity of IBM and how are we doing three things. How are we working on suppliers, employees, and customers from this group? And what are we doing to make sure they're thriving in IBM? And I want them to have money, a conference, start telling us the answers, and start driving for this. And it really changed the company. And it was a way that leadership prioritized this. It's always a priority. It's always in the top 20. But what happens if we put it in the top three? How do we change? You know, how do we make it so that that product shipping meeting never seems to move, but the diversity and equity moves on calendar? Let's not move it. Let's put it in the core. Let's put it right there. And then know that it's a prosperity agenda. It's not only right, but it's also going to drive the bottom line for all of our organizations, whether that's bottom line is commercial or whether it's a social mission, whether it's a governmental service mission. So we wanted to share this because we're going to post it online. And it's really us listening to many of you as in conversations across and putting together a bit of a best practices grid. And what Laura and I talked about was like kind of raise the floor. This is the minimum set of practices that we wish was the new normal everywhere. And that everyone would follow these kinds of best practices, and they wouldn't come in meetings and say, I just don't know what to do. We're like, here's some stuff to do. You know, so we can get everybody to kind of make this the new way that we practice together. So that's part of our goal in shipping that document together with colleagues across government today. So I guess my main thing is I feel like we as a country really have all the resources if we figure out how to elevate these conversations. The most striking for me lives in sort of an insight around Baltimore. So one of the things that was amazing this last year or so was all the things that NASA has been doing, right? Extraordinary. And one of the coolest is going to Pluto. We are the country that's been to visit every planet. We have something on Mars driving around. And that's incredible. We're creating a commercial space industry with colleagues around the world. We have astronauts on the space station. So let's go to Pluto. So the Pluto team, part of the Pluto team's at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, right? Amazing. So at the same time, there's also this amazing researcher named Raj Chetty. If people know Raj, his work at Harvard and now he's at Stanford was around poverty, and he was able to go into and do data science work in the IRS database and look at a lot of different questions they asked in the research, but one of them had to do with location and poverty. And they looked at, does it matter where you live, especially the poorest of Americans' youth, in terms of mobility? Does it matter, do you have the same mobility opportunity no matter where you live, even if you're born in poverty? And it turned out you don't. And it turned out they stack ranked a set of cities. And what city was the worst place to live? On that stack rank of about 40 cities for a child in poverty? Baltimore. Why can it be? How can it exist that within 5 miles of each other are people who are going to Pluto and the poorest youth? That's crazy. But we don't ever figure out how they meet each other. And so what is that take your neighbor to work day plan that we have, that barn raising? Because we are the richest thing in the world, the US federal government. We have the most money of all the governments. We have the most resources, really, of most countries. So how could we have people meet each other more? How do we mix it up? And one of our challenges in this world is the networks don't know each other. And so that hurts us. People would be connected and have more empathy and would do things with each other. There's all these plays that one group's doing. I know a pack of people, if you say to them, hey, did you go to Burning Man or were you at the hackathon yesterday? Did you do that design sprint with those people? I saw that TEDx talk the other day. I got the open data yesterday and somebody made this incredible app on that. And I put it up in the app store and I already got this many views on my Twitter account for it. But like someone starts talking like that, right? We know those people. But a whole bunch of other people don't use that. That's some other thing. Why are we doing that? Why shouldn't we all have that fluent language? Why don't we play the whole orchestra? And so we have to, as government, as leaders, as commercial leaders, as philanthropic leaders, as academic leaders, as citizens, figure out how to not feel like there's tech people and not tech people. Because we've got these crazy stereotypes. If you did tech with this graphic and you figured out you have a whole pack of people, like, I don't do that. You graduate from high school in this country and people actually don't say reading wasn't my thing, but they all day long say math and science, yeah, it wasn't for me. But why would you not use all the tools of the universe, especially on the hardest problems? And even if you don't love that thing, you can find a teammate who does and team up. And so that's sort of my call to you guys as you go into this next phase, you know, of the workshopping and the brainstorming, and really figuring out how this group can catalytically venture catalyze each other. Because in this room and the work everybody's doing is extraordinary. And I'm asking you as a tech leader, don't leave that stuff out just because it sounds, because it felt like third grade when you talked about it. And you're like, I'm afraid of that, or I'm bored by that. Use that stuff too. And if you don't know about it, find someone who does. And pull that Burning Man crew. The president was at South by Southwest, and he said, I love all the restaurant delivery apps, but come help me on these other problems, right? And so let's have them continue to do the amazing things they're doing, but let's pull them in. And they're in all our cities. And let's get an internship for that kid, that Baltimore kid, in the Pluto team, right? And then he or she will change their community, because maybe they'll work on Pluto, but maybe they don't care about Pluto, but they can learn. And then they're going to come solve huge things in their own community on what they care about, what they're passionate about, but with all the tools of the universe. So I'll end there with that image. And I really thank everybody in here. And if you, this is a work in progress, this grid, it's just us grabbing what we heard so far, sending that back out, ready for people to take that and build on top of it. Kind of think of it like a Wikipedia page. We need to add to it all the plays. And we'll keep innovating on that, because all this is raising the floor. But we got to keep going and really debugging together. So thank you so much. I see Tina's here, so I'm going to hand off to her. Okay, thank you.
All right. Feeling good? Yeah. Good. I'm feeling good. I live in Baltimore, and so Megan talked about the disparity between all of the resources we have here in the district with children right down the street who have some of the projected lowest outcomes. If you look on many metrics on living your best lives and self-determination. And I like to always point out to people that language is important. You've heard a lot here about what diversity is, and diversity is not just people of color. And we've somehow moved and code switched to have diversity mean brown people. But everybody is brown people. So I appreciate my brother Michael talking about folk breaking through their fear and talking about diversity. I started this morning saying, blonde hair, blue eye, white man, senior executive service. We don't know if that person has brown children, right? We don't know if that person grew up in Appalachia, right? But we need to ensure that the spaces we are creating allows them to bring their full selves so that everyone can bring their full selves. Right, diversity doesn't start and stop with the way I look. It is all of my experiences. It is my great pleasure to introduce Ms. Tina Chen. She is assistant to President Obama and chief of staff to our First Lady, Ms. Michelle Obama. She's also the executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls, and she's gonna close us out and get us charged up for this afternoon session. So let's give her a round of applause.
Well, thank you, Kalila. I also know I'm the last thing between you and lunch, so I'm really acutely aware of that, and I know you've been at this and hard at work all morning long. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity to say a few words to this gathering. I first want to be able to thank all of our colleagues at the Office of Personnel Management, led by, my good friend Beth Cobert, and especially, Kalila and Venetia, and everyone who has worked so hard. I see Jenny Yang here, too. This has been something we've worked with OPM since the early days of the administration on, and I'm really proud to see it all culminate in the work that we've brought together here in this day-long summit with all of you. I won't go through, because I think it sounds like you have talked a lot about the work that we have done over the course of the administration, both, and as Kalila said, not just on minorities and women, but also to make sure we're including our veterans and that we're including folks with disabilities, that we are paying attention to our LGBT workers. And I'm really proud that we've done work in extending into non-traditional fields, like the STEM workforce work that Megan at OSTP has done, the work that the National Security Council for the first time released several weeks ago, which was a strategy to address the underrepresentation in our defense and national security areas, that has existed for so long and really have a strategy. And Susan Rice has spoken quite powerfully and eloquently about the need for diversity in our national security space. So also something that was near and dear to my heart when I first got here as a single working mom, you know, how we not only recruit and retain folks in our workforce, but how we operate as a workforce, right? So making sure that we are modeling as a federal employer, the largest employer in the country, good workplace practices around workplace flexibility and around equal pay and around flexible scheduling, around teleworking. You know, we have extended that as far as we can to the limits of the statutes, which you all are familiar with. And we believe that that's important. So rather than go through each one of those, which is some of the talking points I got here, I thought I might just spend a few minutes just reflecting back on why we did this and why, in our view, the work remains important. And as I said, this was work that was important to me personally, but also to the President and the First Lady personally, as working parents themselves, when we first got here to the White House. And as we understood in those early days what the demands were both of White House staff and of the federal workforce, we started thinking about what are the ways in which we could model good workplace practices. And it's hard to dial back the clock to 8 years ago, but it actually 8 years ago, things like flexible scheduling and teleworking were kind of like revolutionary. Like, people didn't do them and they couldn't really figure out how to do it. And it was, you know, you had to be present there 9 to 5. That was really how things, the attitude that there was. And, you know, you have to remember that it really was new and breaking new ground, and especially in the federal workforce, to start talking about things like that. That's when the Chico Council started talking about it. And it was a bedrock of how we started to, when we thought about creating the Council of Women and Girls, of having it be truly a council of folks from across every federal agency and every White House office, because we wanted you to have people paying attention to the issues of women and girls, also looking at issues in the broad range of inclusion within each federal agency, not just centrally from the White House, so that we could set a tone at the top, but that it needed to embed itself throughout the federal government. And I'm really proud of the work OPM has done in taking the lead on that, both in big ways that have been really public with the executive orders we've instituted, but in many small incremental ways as well with all the trainings that they know they've done. They've done a lot of work with SES workers in our workforce and our senior career staff. And you know, I'm really quite proud of that entire body of work. And the reason we did that was because the President truly believes that this is the way a 21st century workforce ought to look like. You know, we are responding to this external environment, which is the war for talent, and our young millennial talent that we're competing for, actually, to their credit, isn't, you know, won't stand for the work conditions that those of us, I'm 60, those of us did when we were their age. And they are looking for a balance between their personal life and their work life. They're looking for how they're going to balance their child care needs. So if we want to succeed and make sure the federal government's attracting the best talent, we have to be responsible. It's also, you know, what's important, you know, in how we have a productive workforce, because we also believe, you know, in the science, which our OSTP colleagues tell us, of, you know, what makes for an attentive workforce, what will reduce absenteeism, what will, you know, maintain staff, you know, so that we can retain them in the long run. And that is good workplace policies. It doesn't help not to give people paid sick days, you know, when they're sick to come to work. It's not helpful to require people to choose between a kid's doctor's appointment and their schedule at work. And, you know, we believed, and we still believe, and I believe that as we have implemented these policies, the data will show us out, that we are building, you know, a workforce that is stronger, that is more resilient, that is retained longer, that therefore reduces cost and increases productivity. And that we are modeling that not just for our other colleagues throughout the federal government, but for the entire workforce in the United States. And that this is essential not just to make our federal workforce work better, not just for making our individual companies work better and benefiting our families. It is essential for the country's competitiveness, because guess what? These policies are in place in a lot of other places in the world, and they are going to succeed ahead of us. They're going to get more kids into the STEM careers, because places like Korea and China are outscoring our kids on science and math. They're going to retain their women in the workforce, because people like the Scandinavian countries and the UK and Australia have workplace policies that are more family friendly. So if we don't catch up, we are at great risk in a multilateral world of losing our competitive edge across the way. And you, really, as the largest employer in the country, all of us in the federal government, you know, are key to setting that tone and setting that example. And I really am now, you know, that's the thinking that the president had, you know, when he charged us with this work. It's what has fueled all of us, you know, all the leadership at all of our agencies, OPM and EEOC and the Department of Labor, who've worked together on this in a wonderfully cooperative way. And it is now the work that we pass along to the next administration, but especially to all of you in the career ranks, you know, who will stay here when we, the political staff, have gone. And I fundamentally, because I really do believe in the work, the benefit that we have achieved here around diversity, inclusion, because it strengthens us as a federal workforce, that these are qualities that will outlast us. They are not partisan qualities. They're not red and blue qualities. These are qualities about what it takes to be a good manager, a good workforce, and to stay competitive in this environment that we have now in the 21st century. And so I believe these are qualities that will continue. I hope that we have given you tools. And the other thing that I'm quite proud of is the work that OPM, Labor, EEOC, and others have done to give all of you who will continue on in the federal workforce tools, whether it's in actual rules and regulations, the kind of, you know, policies and procedures that you have, but also the more intangible tools around leadership training, days like today where you're getting to understand some of the science behind and the philosophy and the underpinnings of this work, that's information that you now have that you can now communicate through your entire workforce. You know, a lot of this isn't just about changing the policies and the procedures and the rules around it. A lot of this is about changing culture and attitude. And that's fundamental because it's all part of an ecosystem of how we operate as a workforce. And I think we have been successful in changing that culture and attitude. And that also will not go away. And I believe that that's embedded already. It's what we've tried to work on in the last 8 years. It's what we will continue to work on, you know, whether we are here in the federal government or not. And, you know, I thank all of you for the great leadership you have shown within your agencies up till now, and the great leadership I know that you will continue to show to your workers, you know, to your agencies, and ultimately to the American people, because one of the great privileges for me as someone who came from the private sector to the White House 8 years ago has been to be able to work with all of you, you know, those of you who have devoted your careers in public service and to serving the American public. I'm quite honored to have been counted among your ranks for the last year. I know I speak for both the President and the First Lady when they say they are quite honored by the privilege of having been able to lead you all for the last 8 years. And you all will continue that and continue that work and continue to be the example, especially on an issue as important as this, the diversity and inclusion in the government, which then becomes, you know, a beacon and an example for everyone across the country. So thank you again for all of the work you've done. Thank you again for being just wonderful colleagues to all of us in the political positions who will be moving on. And, you know, thank you for the work that I know that you will continue to do. So I look, you know, have a great lunch and have you know, a great, you know, afternoon in your workshops, workshopping this. And I have my thanks again to everyone at OPM and Department of Labor who put this all together. So great.